Hello, welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast, Hangout, whatever. This is episode 33, and as always, I have here Michael Kimsel, the one and only. Hello, Michael, how are you doing?
That's fine. He should have done 22, but that's maybe a bit rude. I should have done that for 22, anyhow.
Okay, never mind. Well, how are you feeling hot over there?
It is rather hot here. Yeah. I've been traveling the last couple of weeks. I was in Michigan briefly a couple weeks ago for a weekend, and then I was in Minnesota last Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday for the great conference, the Groovy conference, and it was great. It was good. Actually, I'm not sure it was great, but it was definitely good.
Well, definitely the North Hemisphere must have sucked all the heat because it's very cold here in the South. It's a record time for cold. Well, it's actually winter here, but Brazil is never cold.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to say it's your winter now, so it shouldn't be that hot.
Well, but it has been too cold. Well, at least for Brazil, but whoever said that there was global warming was only considering only half of the planet. Well, yes. Anyway, this is JavaScript Hangout, and today we have several interesting topics. Actually, we had too many topics to talk about in the plans, but we had to cut it, or else we would have an even longer show than usual. But the remaining topics are still very interesting, and we can start about one. I think you, Michael, are probably more qualified to talk about because you are a big fan of Firefox, right?
Well, I'm a fan. I'm not sure I'm a big fan, but this is, I think you're referring to Mozilla bug 873709, and that is that Firefox version 23 is disabled. It's removing the ability to disable JavaScript. It's a subject near and dear to many of our hearts. Now, the discussion at the bug shows, I mean, there's a lot of discussion at the bug, and from what I can tell, it's in their bug tracker.
Yeah.
Now, really what it is they're not removing the ability to disable it altogether, but they are taking it away from the preferences box. If you go to about:config, the preference is still there. You can configure it there, but there's no GUI. There's no option to disable it. Though that said, the stuff, I'm sure that I would know where to find it right now. I'm going to go in. Is it advanced? Is it encryption? No, it's not advanced. Is it privacy?
That's another complaint about Firefox. You never find anything in the preferences.
Well, they've changed a lot, but honestly, is it content? Why is enable content or enable JavaScript? Why is that under content? Those things used to be under. They used to be under different areas, even though the areas have changed some. Well, you might probably more legitimately, it could go under security, or it could go under privacy, or it could go under advanced, or it could go under applications. Content makes no sense for that to have for enable JavaScript to ever have been there, but it is what it is.
Well, this reminds me that's probably a good time to make the annual rant of Firefox versus Chrome because.
Go ahead.
I usually write an article, maybe for next month, but because I have some updated stats on usage of browsers from developers that access the site, so I could give more information. Just like you have stumbled in the preferences, you have no idea where things are. It was about time that they added something useful like they have in Chrome for finding configurations by name, and which is very well achieved in Chrome. And I think Firefox developers are saying, "Oh, you are not going to copy Chrome. It's a good idea, man." I think.
Well, it helps, and Google is a search-oriented company, so you'd think that their search would be good in their settings, and it seems to be adequate.
Yeah, but Mozilla invested in doing things that they look awesome, but I'm not sure if they are very useful. Did you notice there is a 3D view of the elements in the...
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
That's awesome, but is it useful?
I think it's useful for some people. Actually, I know it's useful for some people. I've had people tell me that they've used it, and it's been a very easy way for them to track down layering issues where they couldn't see something, they didn't think it was there. It was easier for them to rotate around and zoom in and see, yes, it's there, but it's hidden behind something else.
Yeah, well, okay, I can understand that it's useful somehow, but why don't they implement more important things first, like finding preferences by name, like they have in Chrome?
Well, the standard response with any open source project is just because one feature is implemented doesn't mean that it took the place of something else. It's very volunteer driven, and if somebody wanted to do, or a team of people wanted to do the 3D view thing, that doesn't mean that, oh, they took away time from the preferences reorganization, because it didn't, because nobody seems to want to do it. Now, that's a whole different, that's a leadership issue, and that's an organization issue. That's not a time coding issue.
You know, I think it's more like we are not going to imitate Chrome, because that would mean that Chrome has better features.
that could very well be a contributing component.
Yeah, well, I don't know, but if anybody from Mozilla is listening, please, please, please improve those preference searches, because it has so many options now, and, if you don't want to make it just like Chrome, just do not give in that Chrome has great features, do something different, but at least make it easier to find the options, because the way it is now, it's really pain. And anyway, this was just to talk about the option of taking
disabling JavaScript.
I don't know, I was not able to see how it comes, because I still have Firefox 22, and when I went to check it, there was no upgrade available. I'm not really following Firefox releases. I hardly have time for everything I wanted to do, but what I noticed that if it is not there, according to the bug report, which is actually just a complaint, if it is not there, is there a reason for that? Why did they take it from there?
There's more discussion about that in that bug report thread. They feel like it's going to reduce... it looks like there was something else that was taken out too, not just that, but that will reduce people turning it off by accident and having a lot of the web break, because they'll get support from people saying, oh, nothing works on the internet. Well, they accidentally shut off JavaScript.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that that's the best way to handle that. Personally, having a press here to reset all of your preferences or something like that, you know, reset your browser to a known state instead of having to go to /\\firefox/\\32\random\profiles/.something and then delete a bunch of files that are probably write protected and have it throw warnings at you. Rather than having to do that, have a button that just says, hey, would you like to reset everything to a known state? I'm having trouble. Like, if a page doesn't come up, hey, maybe it's your configuration.
Well, for developers, being able to disable JavaScript, it would be great. I think there are extensions to do that. And that was one of the complaints about Chrome, is that in the past you were not able to disable JavaScript just to test things, although they appear without JavaScript enabled. And then they allowed extensions to do that, and now there are extensions to do that.
There you go. There you go.
Well, long as there is an extension to do that, power users and developers in general will not be left out. Man, can always address that issue, but still I was not very convinced about the reasons why. Actually, I was not even clear about the real reasons, even after reading the comments. And if you are a developer, there are extensions to control the JavaScript support, so it shouldn't affect your development environment. And they said that there will be some option in developer tools window to do that, even if we don't use an extension. But I think it's just for Firefox 24. Well, anyway, moving on with the next topic, something I wanted to... I need to open the right window here first regarding value of. This is interesting because I was not even aware about this function, which just means that I'm not aware of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, but let me screen share it here. Okay, I have to increase the font, and this is an article and in the Sidekicks.js blog. And they explain that if you have a value of a function in your objects, you can use the objects in certain operations that probably are not for objects, are for integers or something else. And this is interesting because Michael, were you aware about this value of?
It's seeming vaguely familiar, but what they're doing.
A new type of, but not value of.
Yeah, no, value of. But what they're doing here, what they're saying is that a lot of primitives have value ofs, have a value of method. You can also create your own on your own objects, and then you can use standard comparison and standard sorting algorithms and whatnot, because all of those assume that there's a value of on whatever's being compared. So adding a value of to your custom objects allows your stuff to be compared. Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have thought of that, but that's how I'm reading it anyway.
Yeah, well, I was not even aware about this value of function, and it seems useful if you like to simplify your code. And sometimes instead of using a getter to get some value from the object to use it in an operation, you can implement that function inside of the object, and you will be able to use the object directly. Mm-hmm. And also related with this, there is a presentation here by Brendan Haick regarding ECMAScript 7, I think, that somehow suggests that this is will be super. This is the confusing part. Is this something new? What is new in ECMAScript 7 that will going to address the manipulation of objects? Could it be that it's not just for reading purposes? Could be also to alter the objects? Oh, that's
beyond my pay grade.
It seems that I'm not able to increase the font here. I tried to do full screen, but I'm not sure if you can read it.
Yeah, it worked when you did full screen.
Okay. Well, from what I get here, probably it's not just to get a value, but also to alter values. And
yeah.
This is just a presentation, so I could not really figure what is really about because lack of context. Just reading the slides does not give me much information. But from what I understood, it would not be just for getting values. You can also, for instance, add values to the an object by using the addition operator, and probably for many other operators. Well, I guess this is useful. Probably you'll make the code more cryptic.
Well, harder to read for some people. It might be less cryptic to other people. But and maybe some of these additions. Not value of isn't even really an addition, but some of these techniques and some of these additions coming up will actually, I'm reading this right now, ECMAScript 7 and 8, some of the things that, what did he just say? Interestingly, the goals of some of the features in ECMAScript 7 and 8 are to make JavaScript a better compilation target. So some of the things that are coming may not be all that useful to day-to-day developers, but if they're things that compilers...
Yeah.
Can target where people can generate code automatically in a more computationally efficient method, that would be or manner, that would be useful too.
Yes, because it, now they seem to have more data types that you can explicitly say. For instance, if you want to have 32-bit integers, you can have them, and you can also have 64-bit integers instead of the default size of an integer value, and that's probably more efficient for code that needs to run faster. And, well, anyway, this is just related with the value of operator. And if other than reading values using the value of function, you can also bind some methods in the objects that will perform certain operations. So you can have a sort of, although they call that in the Java world or C++ world,
overloading
exactly. I think that's good, but from these slides, I'm not sure if that's the case. Anyway, that's for ECMAScript 7, and we hardly have browsers that have embraced ECMAScript 6, so that will take time. Well, moving on to the next topic, now talking about just briefly a comment about an article that I found interesting about testing
testing private
objects with private methods. And what the author here claims is first, is it really useful to have test private functions in any language, not just JavaScript? Well, personally, I admit that I do not do much testing. I often do testing after the fact, like to test if a bug is still there. And but the claim that this article makes is that there are some use cases for testing private methods. Michael, I think you are more familiar with testing in general. What do you think? Should we test private methods at all, or make them public?
I don't know. The guy's article says, hey, that the standard responses are don't test private methods because they're just implementation details, but if you're going to do it, change them to public. And he said, I don't agree with these statements, but they don't make sense for every project. I've encountered numerous situations in JavaScript where I needed to test a function but still wanted it hidden from the public API.
Yeah.
I guess I'm not really sure. I guess I need to see, because I don't think he really describes real-world scenarios in his article.
Exactly.
I can't think of times. I mean, I could think of times where I'd want to. Oh, I want to do this. But from a realistic standpoint, if I've marked something as private, which I generally don't, but if I've marked something as private, the other areas of the code that use it will be the things that I test. So
yeah.
I can't imagine scenarios where I have private methods where I'm testing and all of my tests run except they don't exercise the private methods. I would look at that and say I still don't have enough code coverage then. So I would write enough tests to make sure that the private stuff is exercised however it's being used. He obviously wants to go further and has come up with some clever way to do this. The thing is, however he's doing this, it's not something you could do in every language. And this kind of gets back to, okay, in his scenarios, he can do this, but the generalizable rule still comes back to you probably shouldn't be testing private methods. And not that you shouldn't do it because you can't do it in every language, but it's not something that people do mostly because it's not something that you can do in every language. Not that you shouldn't, but you can achieve pretty much the same results. You can still make sure that they function appropriately as helpers to your other public or protected methods.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
that's just a bit of a rant there, but yeah.
Well, personally, I wouldn't test anything that is not exposed to the to the outside of the object, because it's like it's one of the justifications. It's implementation details, and that may change. And usually, who is responsible for the tests are the same developer that developed the code. But maybe you want to simplify the tests and just go directly to a core function that you just want to call it just for testing purposes.
But his article here ends with, even though private code may be an implementation detail, merely testing the public API may not give you the peace of mind you need when making code changes in the future. Well, then write more tests. But the first comment here is pretty good. I think the reason why people advise against testing private methods is because they're unstable and they're not within the scope of what a unit test is. That's debatable. Unit tests are supposed to test the interfaces to an object without any concern for their implementation. If you've written proper unit tests for your public methods, they should have implicitly tested the private methods. That's a better way of what I was saying before. Because you can't assume that if you move the private method code into a public method, it's going to be exactly the same.
Anyway, there are two problems. One is whether private methods should be tested or not, and the second, even if you decide that they should be tested, it's how. And the solution that he gives here is just to have some conditional code. Well, it's conditional because it is put inside some comments here that you will need some additional tool to strip this code if the code is going to be shipped in production. And all this makes me very nervous because to do all this stunt, you have to have an additional tool to process your JavaScript code.
Yeah.
And do the famous build. Mm-hmm. The build thing reminds me of the complication of the Java world. And Java, necessarily you have to compile your code into bytecode at least. Before you ship it to production. So there is a build process after all. But for projects, for languages like JavaScript and PHP and all languages that do not have to be pre-compiled at development time, all this build thing makes things more complicated. Although I understand that, for instance, if you want to minimize your code because you want to have it optimized for serving JavaScript objects, scripts with the smallest possible size, there has to be a build process. But some people like to complicate things, and sometimes the gains are not really.
We'll have to agree to disagree on that. We'll agree to disagree on that.
you are a fan of the build.
Not a fan.
I like the build.
I'm not a fan, but they're appropriate in some cases.
Yeah, that's what they said when you want to minimize your code to ship.
I don't think it's just that, but we'll talk about it some other time.
Well, if you have a code generator tool, and I use some, not for JavaScript, but for PHP, I have ORM code is generated, not dynamically built into programming. There is a build, but that's like an initial step.
No, but that's not really build. That's generation, so a separate thing. Anyhow.
Well, I have to call make, and there is a build. Well, anyway, this is just a solution for those that wanted to figure out to test private code, and probably they will find it useful. So moving on with the next topic, now we are going to talk about something that sounds amazing, which is a solution for displaying a table or a grid or whatever you want to call it with eventually millions of rows. And this is interesting because it's not only it's an idea, it's not just a theory, it works in practice. And as you can see here, and there is an article about this idea. And if you click here on the 1 million records, it really says it has 1 million records.
It does.
Did you count them?
Yes, that's why I was late.
Well, it shows a number, and Well, I think they have a trick somewhere.
It's not really a trick. It was a lot smoother on my Safari as well too. It was that it was updating. You had blanks in there. It was updating the window far faster than what yours is showing here.
Yeah.
And effectively, they're only rendering the re-rendering the rows in there only what should be shown. It's you call it a trick. I just call it an optimization. It's a smart one. And
but where is the information? Is it in the browser? Is it some hidden object?
Yeah, it's in the browser.
Well, it flickers a lot, but it's pretty fast because probably I'm running Chrome. Probably the refresh rate of Chrome is too fast to avoid flicker. Anyway, it's an interesting technique. I did not go inside the code to figure out if it works in practice. I suppose it hides the objects. Well, it takes the information to display for this table somewhere from some data that is not displayed, and so in the end, the number of DOM objects that it is showing is not so much. I don't know. That's what I suppose. Did you check the code somehow?
No. It's I am looking in the code. Let me open this. No. That's right. It's and then I do. Hold on a second.
Well, this is not this is not some data that is retrieved from Ajax, so
no. Ah, okay. No, it's I'm doing this with Firefox, and it as I'm scrolling, it's dynamically adding rows to the table. It's not just changing what's there; it's dynamically adding more rows and then modifying.
And probably removing
Sure. I don't know if. It is. It is removing some too, but they weren't remove it. Yeah. So we're doing some lazy initialization of stuff. But where the original data is, let me.
did it increase much the memory that is using in the browser? No, I have no idea.
I don't think I have an easy way of checking that right now while we're on this. Let me take just a moment here and say.
Because it was saying that if you try to load 40 or 50K of rows, it would blow up your computer memory.
So it's putting everything into a grid object and just creating a records array in that. So it is, when you do a million, there is a grid object that has a million records inside of it.
Yeah.
And then the code, it's not in here, so it's hard to say exactly where that is. But yeah.
Anyway, I think there is some small print here. For instance, the size of the columns is always the same, so it's probably fixed to some value. Because if you keep adding and removing rows, the layout would have to be redone. So
yeah.
Part of the trick is to fix to set the column the width of the columns to the same. Value for every row to prevent reflows, whatever it is called.
Yeah.
I don't know if this will work well. As you may see, I'm trying to see how. It's interesting. It starts clipping the columns if you try to shrink them. Well, it's a neat trick. It's an interesting use case for you to study if you want to learn how to deal with large amounts of data that you want to display. Just recently, I was discussing in a webmasters forum of Google. There was a guy that was claiming that tables would be much slower to lay out than divs, but he wanted to display data that would be more suitable to be presented in tables.
And just do it in a table.
And right, but somebody probably brainwashed him and say, tables are a sin, you cannot use tables.
Yeah.
Use tables when it makes sense to use tables. And it was actually even worse. They wanted to replace tables by images. Well, images are much slower.
Yeah.
And if you want, they do not adapt to the...
They don't deal with the accessibility concerns of screen readers, nor are they terribly semantic divs by themselves.
It was a stupid idea.
Yes.
The reason that probably why the guy is finding tables were slower is sometimes the layout of the cells depends on the contents, and if the contents are lazy loaded, like images or images that do not have predefined width and height, and probably it forces the browser to relay out the table cell several times, and that makes the browser slower because it has to redo the table layout many times. And I think it's interesting because in this case of this technique to show a lot of rows in a table, they have worked that out very well to avoid variable width that.
Yep.
Width and height that can would force the browser to relay out, and well, the effect is very neat, and kudos for the author of this idea to or the implementation, because I think he has gone through a lot of effort to avoid the problems. Okay. Anyway, moving on to the next topic, this which is to talk about something that. Coincidentally, we've been talking about it more recently in the PHP world, which is the use of generators and the yield keyword. Well, at least first one with people starting to talk about generators for PHP, I could not really understand how the flow would work. But in practice, the generators are just a way to iterate over something that you probably don't know exactly when it will end, like for instance iterating over a database query result set, and then there is the yield keyword that you can use to return some value for an iteration. But here in the case of this article that which mentions about, I think this is an extension for Node.js, right? Or is it Vue 2?
Yeah. This is NVM install 0.11.2, and it's not an extension. It's part of Node.js. It's part of this most recent release.
Oh, okay. Oh, NVM install. I'll see it here.
Yep.
So it's built in now, right?
Yes.
So that's great because it's one less thing to rely on whatever is the version, whatever is the installation of Node.js that you may have. Well, anyway, the use case that they present here to use generators and the yield keyword is to solve the problem of how do I wait for something to happen after a period of time. And
as something is happening, every time you call a particular function or a generator, I should say, as it's generating values, it yields back a value as a return that returns it back, but it may not be done. It's basically signaling back, hey, I've got this, here's this value, and because of the async nature of some languages more than others, those returns could be dealt with asynchronously. So as things are being pulled and calculated, or maybe iterating over 50 images, as each of them are being, some are large, some are small, as they're, each one is done, it yields that back. They're still going to be done sequentially, but some of them may come back as one is done. The result processing from that could be done asynchronously from the result processing of the next one, and so on.
Well, in practice,
will it change? Yeah.
The ULQ word in practice, it's just like a return, except that it's not a return. And in the case of this function, it...
Here's another way of saying it. It's returning a value, but it's not returning control of the program. It's not returning execution flow or execution control. It's just returning a value only.
This is still a bit confusing, and but it, at least it addresses one concern of how do I address this this problem of sending of waiting for something that probably will take some time to happen, and only then proceed and do something else. So in this case, the yield keyword will return this slip function. I think it returns a promise object or something like that. And but the real return will only happen when that the condition here is satisfied, and in the case of this promise is to pass to 1,000 milliseconds, and only then it really returns this string. It's still a bit confusing, but I think if people start studying this model, start making more sense out of it. I don't know. Do you think this is going to help, or maybe it's too complicated for people to?
Probably both. It is potentially a complicating factor for people to think about, but the Node.js fan club has never shied away from adding asynchronous complexity to any problem, whether it really needed it or not. And this is just going to be one more tool in their tool belt to let them asynchronize the world.
Yes, they're very, very few things are synchronous in Node.js, and that's because that started with that concept of making everything asynchronous and eventually more efficient. But obviously that's some complexity that probably some people would not like to have to deal with. And there was some discussion, at least in the past, I don't know if people are still discussing it, whether Node.js will be so successful that it will be more popular than PHP. Well,
no.
PHP is simpler and has so many applications that make it popular that all this synchronicity, I don't know if that word exists, would help or make it harder to adopt Node.js. Well, I think those are very different worlds, and they have their audiences, but in terms of popularity, I don't think it helps to have forcing this asynchronous stuff makes programming more complicated. Everything the person needs to do that takes some time, like database queries, accessing files or networks, you have to deal with callbacks or promises or whatever, and all this is not very... very productive or even easy to understand for most people. Anyway, moving on with the next topic, just mention briefly that does that deserve
I don't know.
Music. It's just the announcement music for Node.js, I mean PhoneGap 3 that was just released just a few days ago. And, well, personally, I do not use PhoneGap, not because it's not good, just because I did not have an opportunity to use it in any project that I developed. But I think it's interesting in general for the JavaScript developers community, because once in a while you may have to develop a mobile application, and PhoneGap is a solution. There are several interesting new things they have announced. I'm not going to go through them because since I'm not a regular PhoneGap user, probably would not be able to evaluate their importance. I don't know if you want to comment anything about this, or Michael.
I already played my song. I will point out that PhoneGap 3 now is deliverable as a Node Package Manager package, so you can install it via NPM. And I'm presuming, based on their comment, that it will keep it up to date. Well, you will be able to download and keep it up to date, probably far more conveniently and probably with less bandwidth than, as they were saying in that page, downloading zip files for every version. So, Node to the rescue. Look at that. It's infecting everything. I mean, it's spreading everywhere.
Yeah. And everything is asynchronous. Okay. Well, now we are getting closer to the end of this podcasting. I'll just to have the regular section on which you comment on the latest winners of the JavaScript Innovation Award that goes on the JS Classes site. We had five candidates, and as you may see here, all of them are from different authors, which is great. I just wish we had more, but the site is still growing, so we have to be patient. Anyway, Michael, which ones would you like to comment?
Well, I am trying to pull down a tab so that it's... Yeah, there we go. Okay, so a couple I was going to point out. Yeah, I lost my... here we go. Pull this. Go turn left at Greenland. There we go. There.
Yeah.
So, two. First off is this JavaScript push history, push state generator, I should say. So let me go back. This is from Martin Barker over in the UK. G'day, Martin. I know that's not really English, but you can still understand it. Logic builds URLs to add history to push state. Push state has been something a lot of single-page apps try to keep track of. It has not been on my radar for a while, but it's strange because I downloaded... Oh, maybe here, two things. I downloaded the code, but I only got one file. And so he has an example JS file here, which would be some example code of how to use it. Push state, push something in, get push URL. Push that, push a page in, get it. But I brought this up to so you could see it's pretty small. That's what it is. It's just one anonymous function that gets called that adds push state gen and adds something. Oh, get. I thought I was adding a get push URL push and so on. Yeah. So it's pretty tight, pretty small amount of code. Comments wouldn't have gone amiss in there, I have to say. But that said, that's just me saying that. So push state gen.
Yeah. Well. Well.
Back to you.
Well, push state is not exactly a new thing. It's what's new here. Just this object tried to simplify things by combining some parameters from your current request and with some additional parameters that you want to use and generate a new URL and address is a regular need of when you have to use push state on your object. So this, as it uses, kudos for Martin for his contribution.
Yes, thank you, Martin. Okay.
Okay. So, and
moving on to you, if you want to mention something.
Oh, I don't know. Usually we can all alternate this time. Well, on my behalf, I'll comment a few classes here, but just to comment one at a time. Let me screen share it here. It's always a challenge. Oh, I was already screen sharing it. Okay, I'll start with Ajax link down drop down menu creator, which is a very similar component to another one that we showed last month for generating linked menus and things like that. And this time it is a drop-down select list creator, and it's probably better to show an example that the author has provided here, because it's practically an application that lets you build dynamically link down menus, as you may see here, every time you change the select the option, it shows some text that you have shown here. You can add more levels, and they all get linked. And well, that's basically it. And there is the possibility to save your definitions of your menus to some text file on the server side or database, but that requires some PHP code, which is also part of this package. So this package has two parts, one for server side in PHP and another for JavaScript. And that's why this package was nominated. And once again, Marplow provided an interesting component, which is basically also a component, a JavaScript component and a PHP component, and I think it is useful. So, do you want to comment the next one, or shall I?
Carry on. You're doing very well. Thank you.
Well, so I do not stop the screen sharing. Next, I would like to comment about this jQuery AJAX file upload, which addresses one usual limitation of AJAX requests, at least for AJAX XML HTTP requests version 1, which would not allow you to compose a file upload request because you do not have access to the contents of a file to compose a full HTTP request. So the workaround here is to use iframes. I've been using this solution like this for many years. Usually, I have a server-side component in PHP to take the request, AJAX request, and take the file upload. And the trick here is to create an hidden iframe object and redirect, change the target window of the form file upload to the iframe, so you do not see the result because the iframe is very small, it's practically hidden. But it allows you to have some JavaScript code to communicate with the iframe and see the results. And in this case, it is a jQuery plugin that achieves that. And I think it was a good JavaScript-only solution for this problem. In this case, it was implemented by Satyam Kumawat. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name.
Yes,
he's
you
from
are.
India. Oh, you know how to spell it right. I forgot you are the expert on foreign languages or foreign names.
Oui, chanson de moi.
Well, anyway, moving on to the next nominee, I just want to comment about this briefly because I don't know much about this component. I mean, I know about this component because I nominated it. I nominated it, but I'm not sure if I can explain what is its use in the real-world applications. It is to test propositional logic with Kripke models.
Wow.
I had to go on the Wikipedia to understand what is a Kripke model.
It still doesn't help, does it?
Well,
no, it doesn't.
What I could figure is that Kripke models are useful to evaluate relational logic conditions. I think it, from what I can remember, is when you need to relate sets of information. Like when you have database queries, you need to do perform joins. So this object somehow helps you in that. I cannot explain what does in practice this can be so good. I'm sorry. It's even a shame that I have nominated this on the faith that this does something innovative. I think it does, but I can hardly explain this because it depends some knowledge that I do not have on this area. I'm sorry, but anyway, thank you for Daniel Martinez for another interesting package. He has been submitting several packages is from Spain, and I hope he continues to.
Hola, Daniel.
To submit more interesting components besides this one. And I think there is only one last for you to comment.
I've got it right here. My window is up. How come my screen isn't the big one? Look at that. Beautiful. Oh, I'm in the wrong. Yeah, hang on. I'm making the wrong. Randall Allen Anderson. Didn't mean to merge in two things there. In the good old US of A, fitting that we end this on the United States. This is a Sudoku board game, but it can also take images that you upload. And I've actually got it.
Are you a Sudoku player, Michael?
No. Well, I mean, I occasionally in certain areas, but I'm not going to go into that. This is actually the code running. So I could put an 8 there, and I could put a 7. Whoops, I could put a 2 here. And can't do a 2. Can I do a 3 here? Yeah, I can do a 3 there. And I can do a 2 here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I guess I can put a 9 there. Oh, I can't put a 9 there because it's already there. It's telling me. Now, the thing is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. When they first load up the page, these loaders are here, and it's a little confusing. So I can load up 9 images. I have no idea what these images are, so bear with me. They could be rude.
Surprise!
Yeah, I don't know what this, but I was trying to get this to work with the image part, because the idea is that this takes your images, breaks them up, and then those become the parts rather than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Your parts of your 9 images get thrown around, but I can't get that to work.
I think you show should setting. Upload.
Yeah, I don't see an upload button anywhere.
Maybe it already looks weird. Probably the layout is a bit stretched. There is some submit button somewhere.
Maybe it's hidden. Maybe he should have used the AJAX file uploader. From the earlier one. That said, not picking on you too much, Dan normally would have been able to do, but getting the pictures to work would have been nice. There may have, dragging icons from the, once loaded, okay. Long and short is I can play it without the images. I was having a hard time getting it to play with the images, but easy. I'm on the easy level, new puzzle. There you go. It works. Two. So here's the PicDoku.js. Not too large. What is that? It's 693 lines of JS in one file, and then HTML and CSS and so on. But that's the PicDoku. There's also Sudoku Puzzle Generator. A lot of comments in this one. So it looks like he had actually taken the Sudoku Puzzle Generator and then made an image slice version on top, though I couldn't get the image stuff to work.
Yeah, probably there's some submit button hidden there so you could upload the pictures. Well, anyway, this practically ends our hangout for this month.
Yeah, there you go.
We covered several interesting topics. Actually, we had more to comment, but it was going to get very long, and maybe next month we can cover whatever.
I think I will have a haircut. I've been needing a haircut for a while.
That will change the topics of the hangout.
Yes, my goodness.
Quite
shaggy.
I am cutting my hair because it's getting already less than it used to be. I shouldn't cut much further. Anyway, with this we have practically ended the hangout. I'd just like to thank you again, Michael, for coming. And next month we have more other interesting JavaScript
Excellent.
Topics to comment, as always.
Okay. Excellent.
That's all for now. Bye. We'll be right back.